Hey. Yeah, you know, Busted Pencils, fully leaded education talk, educated educators talking education. Class is in session, and everybody's like, Johnny Lupinacci, Jacob, chairman of the board, Tim Slecker, you guys are going to talk about bombing Iran, aren't you?
Oh, Tim, man, I'm sort of with you. I would rather not today. I mean, it's heavy. It's on the hearts and minds of probably all of our listeners, certainly on us. Not big fans of wars here, especially unconstitutionally, you know, aggressive ones, preemptive maybe even, to just add a little commentary into what we're not going to focus today's shows on, our show on. I mean, we're going to have to dig into it, especially as social studies teachers.
Yeah, we're going to.
Fortunately, most students aren't in class right now, so we don't have to immediately dive into how do you teach about violent conflict, especially when, you know, your country is entering the citizens, the good people of democracy here in the United States, into a war. And Tim, you and I spent the better part of all of our life into our adulthood at war as a country. I mean, most of our...
You and I haven't been at war our whole life.
No, we haven't been deployed to it, but certainly our classmates, our friends all were in some kind of armed conflict officially, you know, engaged in by the United States, and probably into most of Jacob's youth as well. You know, it's only been recent that we've been out of war, and it looks like here we are, getting back into it. So we'll dive into that as we unfold with recording more this week. And Tim, though, I like your plan. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk education. Get a little breather break.
A little breather. Yeah.
Escalating conflict with Iran.
Yeah, because we will get into it. And, you know, maybe a little touch and, you know, thinking for the Saturday show, we'll dig into it. And
sounds like
people might be... Maybe I'll just give a little teaser. Might be a little surprised on where I might come out on this one. Yeah. So, you know, get it going. But, hey, you know, we are living in an anti-DEI, full-on free speech world, however those things work out. But, you know, Johnny, you know, a piece here in the New York Times that came across, and I think this is an interesting classes in session topic, because this could be presented as, well, you know, I mean, they do have free speech, or is this not a free speech? What I'm talking about here, a white nationalist wrote a law school paper promoting racist views. It won him an award. No, this is not The Onion. Typically, you know, 5-10 years ago, this would have been a wonderful Onion headline. It's not. It's the New York Times. The University of Florida student won an academic honor after he argued in a paper that the Constitution only applies to white people. From there, the situation spiraled. And please, you know, if you have a chance, if you have a subscription, check out the article. But, Johnny, we're going to talk about this from the standpoint of saying, was this in a college an exercise of free speech? And as an institution of higher education, and if you're a professor, if you're a teacher, how do you deal with an issue like this where somebody says, I'm allowed to do this because it's my free speech right to make my point. And in fact, I won an award for this paper because I followed incredibly in tight, you know, writing parameters on how to put together an essay. I'm a second year law student. I'm not a freshman just spouting off stuff. And I grounded my argument in legal theory of the time. And my professor was the one who nominated my paper for an award. So why y'all jamming down and yelling at me and calling me a racist? I don't know. Well, maybe. When all I did was write a paper. And, Johnny, as you're thinking about this, I'm just going to point out that I have had this happen when I was teaching social studies methods. I had a student, now didn't proclaim to be an originalist constitutional scholar who was coming out of this from a theoretical framework, but did kind of point out in a paper that she was very concerned that diversity, and in fact, the teaching for tolerance lesson that I was showing them, was going too far and it could be a problem. And she wrote in a paper that Dr. Slecker, I don't believe I have any authority to go in and teach this tolerance. And I don't believe that that's my job when I go out to teach. And I will say at that time, that paper created, and we were a nationally accredited teacher education program, that at the time this happened, my colleagues and I saw this as something that we needed to bring up to the student to talk about, because this would, at least from all of us at that point of time, this violated potentially our accreditation if we didn't address this issue with the student, because our national teacher accreditation required that we were doing anti-racist work with future educators. And so I'm looking at this and going, wow, where would I be today if this happened? And where would my institution be on this? Would they stand behind me? And I'm just thinking about this, John, like, what does a teacher, a professor to do when you get presented with, and let's be honest here, we're talking, you know, let's just get some names out there. Preston Damski is the university law student at the University of Florida. He is really trying to come out. The originalism is the constitutional theory that he was basing his paper on. And his professor was a judge who was teaching the course, and it was a Trump-nominated judge, and that was John L. Badalamenti. And he's the professor who said, good job, my boy. Way to go out there, Preston, and put together a really tight originalist framing of the Constitution and saying, white people, stop allowing these inferior minorities to vote, because the Constitution was always only intended for white people. And I'm just sitting there going, and you read through the article, there's some deeper things here. It isn't necessarily all rosy, but, you know, I had no second thoughts when this student presented me with a paper that was presenting to me and my colleagues at the time a feedback that was supporting, you know, kind of racist viewpoints. And we challenged that student. And I have a feeling that if I did that today, this might be a New York Times article about me.
Well, Tim, it could be, right? I mean, there's a lot going on in here, and I haven't read this work or closely followed this story, but have a similar experience in a social studies methods class, you know, about a decade or so now ago. And it was, you know, about a student's work who wrote, you know, a unit plan around, you know, women shouldn't be allowed to vote. Mm-hmm. That students should explore and learn that, in favor of that. And for a lot of reasons, it didn't fly, not because of free speech, although that was brought into the investigation and the claims that the student made about having to redo that unit planned and about the grade received for the work done. But as a good teacher, one of the things that I learned earlier than that higher, more controversial event I was involved in was that everything, and I hate to be litigious about this because I'm not a lawyer, but we live in a very law-conscious culture, you know, and our syllabi, the syllabus for a course is a binding contract with students, right? Like, this isn't a surprise. There's a clear definition of the assignment.
Johnny, just do a quick on what a syllabus is.
Well, syllabus, for people listening, is basically usually on the first day or ahead of the first day, but early in the course, you get a agreement on what the assignments are going to be in the class, what we're going to be reading, what are the required tasks, the calendar of the course, you know, the books required for the class. It's all outlined, and there's always some flexibility in a good syllabus, right? So in a good agreement with students, it's sort of like a business contract that students have with their instructor. Many times those instructors are professors or experts in a particular area of study, like having an appointed judge teaching a law class. This is certainly common practice at a number of universities. But, you know, in our syllabus, Tim, you know, one, like you said, we're required by our accrediting agencies to teach certain things. We have learning objectives that they sort of, I would say, approve of, but also somewhat mandate.
Right.
Right. For us to have our accreditation. And we work with teachers who work with children. And so also we talk about it on Busted Pencils a lot. Education is a state right. So you have certain state obligations and learning objectives, especially in social studies. And so, you know, having being a teacher in the state of Washington, I primarily, you know, am held responsible to, yes, those federal, larger national accrediting agencies for what teachers should know and be able to do in classrooms, but also at my state level. And the state of Washington is strongly aligned with human rights, and within the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, our children's rights. And so for me, introducing my social studies course, talking about how as teachers, we teach with the best information we have. We teach with scientific consensus. That includes, you know, the hard sciences, but also that includes history as a set of practices, historical research. It includes poli-sci, like political science, and consensus, scientific consensus on what constitutes a healthy education for children. And so by having those requirements of the not only the course, the program, the accrediting agencies obviously, you know, have some say on that, but also in my class, saying, hey, this assignment doesn't fall under those categories. This assignment, in fact, goes against. It's children learning information that goes against their rights, which isn't necessarily a bad thing if they were learning it. Remember, we said we don't give equal time to the false equivalency. Are there people who believe that young women and grown women in our culture shouldn't vote, shouldn't be allowed to vote? Certainly they are there, but scientific consensus, right, around the world is that you should be able to vote no matter who you are. A human being is a human being. This is not like a restricted category based on gender identity. So, you know, and that overlaps into this a little bit, Tim, because part of the paper written for this originalism assignment also suggests removing voting rights for non-whites. So it's tangent to a similar kind of thing. I don't know the requirements of the assignment. I doubt that it was saying you have to take a particular perspective aligned with consensus, with legal consensus, world court stuff, US courts, you know, those kinds of things, state courts, federal courts. I don't know the actual parameters of the assignment. It could be really well done, as was the unit plan that this future teacher did, was very well done. However, not my first rodeo as a teacher, teaching something that maybe someone might choose to teach and give equal time to the false equivalency, like 4 weeks of a unit plan to the viewpoint that men should only vote, which is highly problematic, right? So if you're mentioning it, like it's, we're not saying censor it and don't teach about, you know, opposing views or outside views or alternative views. They exist and they're important to note and know about. We don't want to stick our heads in the sand and be naive to many diverse perspectives. But the idea of them being, but what's general consensus around what's a strong democracy? You know, what upholds human rights, which is part of democracy in these things. And so it didn't meet the qualifications of the assignment. However, the student did get great feedback on aligning assignments to objectives,
right,
on writing skills, on, you know, choosing good forms of assessment, but they had to redo it, and they were allowed to keep that perspective in the broader lesson, but to give it an equal representation of, like, what are the numbers? How many experts in democracy advocate for men only to vote? Well, very, 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 very few. And so let's not give equal time to the false equivalency. Let's do something. Here's the math teacher in me, you know, a ratio proportionate to scientific consensus. And so they had to redo their unit plan. And it was a whole big thing around, did that encroach on the students' free speech? And it didn't. It was found by our attorney general's office as not being an infraction on students' rights to free speech, because it gave them an accurate opportunity to participate in free speech, but not one that's disconnected from the reality of consensus.
Yeah.
Right. And so this gets to be a tough area, right? Because free speech and academic freedom sometimes clash.
Yeah, they do. Right?
So let's give a little, like, street level definition on what freedom of speech is. Can I do that, Tim?
And then give a street,
because it's class in session, and then give a definition for academic freedom so we could talk about how sometimes those things clash. And I would say those clashes are really important, especially in learning spaces, because we say it all the time here, democracy is messy. We have to have dialogue, and we have to apply best available knowledge to reaching common good. And sometimes free speech and academic freedom clash and help us get to a level of what's the common good. But a core definition for free speech, and again, I'm not a legal expert or a lawyer, but this is kind of my operational definition as a social studies educator and as someone who, you know, teaches courses on politics, culture, and society. But the core definition that I run by is that free speech, especially on university campuses, is referring to the right of students, faculty, or any invited speaker to express ideas, opinions, and viewpoints without prior restraint or punishment by the institution, subject to reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions and categorical exemptions. Generally, and again, I'm not a lawyer, so this is not me giving you legal advice, but in my experience, those categorical exceptions are generally around when does free speech, aka what we might call hate speech, right, go against an inclusive environment, or even go as far to create an unsafe or a threatening environment, or maybe even a catalyst or violence towards particular groups of people. And so that's usually generally how I understand that exemption, right? So if you're saying this is a viewpoint, but it's not a viewpoint supported by the university. In fact, if you move forward with this viewpoint, you very well could be held responsible for actions that are not covered under your free speech, like harm to others, right? Or the threat, or those kinds of things. So now that seems like, wow, it's sort of like anything goes. It's not quite anything goes, but you know, freedom of speech is really important. But freedom of speech doesn't mean equal time to the false equivalency. Right? Like, I could say, Tim, I think it's a better world if everybody chopped off their right arm. You know, it would strengthen everybody's left-hand abilities. And I could have that viewpoint. And medical experts and people all over the world would say that is not supported in general by scientific consensus. And maybe I could even take such a radical idea as far as to say, hey, we've tried it out. I've cut my right arm off, and I think it's a pretty good way to live. So everybody should teach what life is like with two arms or with one arm, right? And so that's not exactly how it works, because scientific consensus would say, hey, you know, we should probably focus on what our best of our abilities and knowledges are to having both the right and left hand. I'm digressing a bit because it's an extreme example here, but the idea being is like, I can't give equal time to that divergent idea, but I have freedom to that idea. Academic freedom, which is close to free speech, but sometimes, as I said, in conflict with it, is a good definition is that the campus, especially campus speech, right? Because we talk about academic freedom, we think about campuses, and this includes like our high school campuses, our public education realm, includes in it what we call, like, free speech includes this thing called academic freedom the right of faculty and students to pursue knowledge, conduct research, and engage in scholarly discourse without institutional interference based on the content of their ideas. So technically, Tim,
mm-hmm.
there is a case here for academic freedom. Should a student be allowed to pursue studying with information out there, the idea that, like, we may be vehemently opposed to, and scientific consensus may go against it, right? But should they have the right to explore it, mm-hmm. research it? And I would say absolutely yes, but with the context and responsibility to the fact that it is a divergent idea, and to include in that investigation the reasons why it's such a divergent idea, i.e. that it's racist, right? In the case of this student's, you know, white nationalist originalism essay or paper, right? And so, like, thinking about, like, saying, hey, this is to explore what might happen. And again, I wouldn't advise it. It wouldn't be permissible in under any of my syllabi. That's the plural word for syllabus, that legal binding contract that you have with students at the beginning of any semester or course. But it might be one in this particular course. It might be fair game in that course. Nobody, to my knowledge, is saying, Tim, that this is best practice, that this is scientific consensus or, in general, an adoptable idea. But it is an idea, and there's a slippery slope here. Again, remember, resident anarchist here. Like, not promoting hate speech, obviously not. But let's not stick our head in sand and say that these viewpoints don't exist. In fact, let's research them. And also, in the process of that research, illuminate how they might be bad ideas. You know? So I'm kind of in the middle on, like, I need more information. Although, like, my gut and visceral reaction is like, what are we at? Where? So I'm with you, Tim. Like, what's going on these days where, like, our energy and resources are spent on this kind of stuff? Sadly, though, like, you know, AFT president reminded us, like, children are the battlegrounds of these political, you know, contests right now. Well, extend children all the way up into law students, right? Now, I think they're a lot less vulnerable than children. But again, the battleground for political ideology, come on, man. Like, that's, like, let's have a good context. And I don't know the details.
Maybe, well, I can say, no.
This
so
is
look,
a great essay because it sparks these dialogues.
You, I mean, and this is to say, thank you. It is a classes in session. So for everybody to be brought up on all of that, Johnny just really laid it out there. And so there's, you know, potentially some things going on here. You could potentially say, is Mr. Damski bringing up an originalist point of view, throwing it out there as a historical fact that there are originalists out there, and that maybe even some of the original writers, maybe they did mean white people only. But see, that's not what he does in his paper. He literally takes it as a fact and advocates for it, and in fact says that our legal system, in fact, is all wrong right now because it's not following the Constitution. He goes even further and, you know, also reveals himself in other things because, of course, he goes to social media a lot. And talking about President Trump and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, they are, quote, controlled by the Jews. And Mr. Damski,
oh, that's where it goes, yeah, into anti-Semitism.
Mr. Damski said, you know, about the Jews, they are the common enemy of humanity. He has also lamented, quote, the self-flagellatory mindset of modern-day Germans, noting their failure to revere Hitler. Now, all of that, you know, Johnny, we're sitting there going, okay, this is absolute 100% racism. This violates and creates a hostile environment around the campus. People are fearful for their own physical safety. Okay. The other issue here, though, that I think is a worrisome point is the university's failure to step up and say, we don't support this work. We don't support this student. They've gone too far.
If I'm right, the student is expelled, though.
Yeah, I mean, now, but they have the this floor has said they are taking, let me, I got to find this quote again, institutional neutrality. And claiming that, essentially saying it's not our business. And that's where I see also the part of a potential teacher or a faculty member being like, if your institution isn't going to have your back on an issue such as this, the, as you say, what are we now going to get into is that anything goes. Essentially, to me, this is the message that's being put out by this University of Florida Law School is that, hey, anything goes. And why is an institution taking that position? Come on. We know why they are, because look at what has happened here in the last 8 months or so is the all-out assault on the academy, academia, and fear of getting in trouble by the current administration for advocating, you know, God forbid, advocating that, hey, you can't do that stuff. That's hate speech. They don't want to be targeted by the current administration for being too DEI. And this here, though, Johnny, I just think, yeah, the student has been expelled. The faculty member has had no type of sanction or things that I can see here in this article. Maybe this has happened since then. This is, you know, so we look at this and we think about this as teachers and as faculty members. And, you know, again, going back to Johnny, you had the great example. I had the, I don't know if we'd say them great examples, but very much an example very similar to this. And at a time, I had no problem pointing out the problem with this student's position, and my institution at that time would have been 100% behind me on top of the national accreditation. And I point out, you know, bringing this to a classes in session, what are we supposed to do? Before you feed back, though, Jacob's been sitting there listening to this whole thing, and I wonder, though, Jacob, you know, what do you hear? Because it sounds like, you know, Mr. Adamski is probably close to your age in this sense, his second year law school. What are you hearing when you hear me and Johnny talk?
At first, I was glad that I just wasn't involved in the conversation because it sounded very controversial. I was thinking, oh, good, Johnny and Tim are going to handle it. I don't have to even wade into this. This guy sounds like a real jerk, Tim, based on what you said. I have no problem with the academic work if you want to point out that you found some legal construct, which people should know about if that is a case that can be made. For me, I would say, oh, good, now we know there's this argument. We can get working on that. I'm glad Attorney General Pam Bondi didn't think of it first, because then that's in action. I'm glad it's getting done academically, and we can work on that later. I think we do free speech pretty well in this country. I think our method is better than the European one, where it's like, well, we've got free speech, but you got to get your speech license, and might get pulled if you say something bad about the Queen. I don't like that very much. Overall, it sounds like things worked out. He got expelled, and we can have this good conversation here between us three nice folks. So that's where I land.
Yeah, I love that. Jacob's point. Jacob highlights a real-time proof of free speech. Like, we're having this conversation, which is key. We talk about dialogue as a key component to democracy, being able to have free speech, even in times where, you know, you may hear people say it's under siege, it's under threat. It's like, yeah, but that's why, but we are able to talk about it. And that is part of our civic responsibilities to have these dialogues and that peer accountability that Jacob's speaking to. Like, our, like, what you believe you should be putting into practice, and you should be held accountable by your peers. It is not anything goes, and it is not individual liberty in this country. That is not democracy. You can have freedom to those viewpoints, but you can't assume them or assert them as the way for everybody. And in fact, that's kind of one of the things. Like, I'm with Jacob. I'm glad we're able to talk about it. I'm glad, you know, not. I guess that's a stretch. I'm not glad that, you know, this paper was written, but should someone be feeling as passionate as maybe this student felt about it or chose to just do an experiment? I don't know. The student might even say, I don't really even believe this. I don't know the details, right? But they did an assignment. And now we're having a conversation about it because certainly racism exists. Mm-hmm. Certainly there are people who said, well, the Constitution is what it is. It was written when it was written and it was way better back then. And we want it like that now. I mean, that seems outrageous, but we also have like listeria outbreaks and all kinds of threats because we're throwing modern science out the window right now, currently at the same time. So I think it's an important conversation. It's a sad one that we're having it, but it's an important one that reminds us to do things like have university spaces where we can investigate, look closely at all the information, have conversations about it. And the most important conversation, like Jacob said, peer accountability. That's on all levels, like students who might not yet be experts, but certainly they're citizens. That's a level of peer accountability. The people in your community, the neighborhood who is affected by those viewpoints, that's peer accountability, right? The experts, let's not erase expertise, the legal experts on all the domains that this touches on, human rights lawyers, right? Civil rights lawyers, all the ways that they might say, yes, this view exists, but historically, another group of experts who are part of the peer conversation, historically, here's how it's played out. And that's where we get to things like, hey, this creates a hostile and threatening environment. In particular, it sounds like in this case, against Jewish folks, which is a form of racism, anti-Semitism. And it's been historically connected to extreme violence against groups of people that modern democracies have said, remember the phrase in social studies, we learned it and we taught it, never again. Mm-hmm. Well, here we are. What's our civic responsibility as educated citizenry? Not even as professors or experts on these matters, but as democratic citizens with a civic responsibility to the common good, which includes within it human rights, children's rights, right? And so, Tim, I think this is a great conversation, and I applaud you for bringing it to class today.
That's it, but I tell you what, after this class is in session, I'm not sure about peer accountability. I think it is beer accountability after this. Oh, and now it's time for your moment of zen. Education becomes most rich and alive when it confronts the reality of moral conflict in the world.
Hey, thank you out there listening to Busted Pencils class in session today. You can always grab great podcasts just like this one. Just got to search Busted Pencils on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and of course, you can always find Busted Pencils at the Civic Media website, or you can get at us at bustedpencils.com. And don't forget to find us throughout the week, every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, with homerooms, class in session, and always loads of fun to wrap up the work week with Friday's very own Jacob Producer's Choice. And listen up, you pencil busters. You can always grab Busted Pencils at 3 p.m. Central Time. That's right. We broadcast across all the Civic Media Network stations for 1 hour of your favorite blue-collar scholars, Tim and Johnny, and keep busting pencils.